Welcome this morning. Good. That's my first question. So did I. And I didn't even ask for one, which I'll talk about a little bit later this morning. How many folks did dream last night or were able to remember dreams? Good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. About 10 of us. You know, so far I haven't been talking a lot about dreams per se. But there's a reason, and that again is to build the common ground and to understand a little bit of the spiritual geography which goes on within us. And then the dreams will begin to, I hope, begin to take shape or carry deeper meaning, and things will start to connect for you. This morning, I'm going to be talking about the dynamics of the unconscious, building on what we talked about yesterday, and get into this a little bit. We're going to do some small group work. I'm going to give you a tough assignment. I'm real curious to see how you do with it. And that'll be kind of fun. Just do what you can with it. And then we'll close by talking. I'm going to give you some very practical suggestions about how to access the dream world, which some of you are wondering. In fact, I've got a wager on with somebody in here that by Friday they're going to be able to retrieve a dream fragment. So I've got to make sure that that I give the instruction so that happens. Let me, though, go back to yesterday and kind of start there. I was very intrigued by the Bible study. Very, very intrigued about the discussion about the poor and the rich. And if you look at the diagram of the psyche, I hope that some of you might be able to see some connections, some parallels between the tension between these parts of ourselves and, in fact, the political dilemma that was being explored here at the end. Let me read you something from Carl Jung, from a little book called Modern Man in Search of a Soul. He said, "The acceptance of oneself, the acceptance of oneself is the essence of the moral problem and the epitome of an whole outlook upon life. That I feed the hungry, that I forgive an insult, that I love my enemy in the name of Christ, all these are undoubtedly great virtues. What I do unto the least of my brethren, I do unto Christ. But what? What if I should discover that the least amongst them all, the poorest of the beggars, the most imprudent of all the offenders, the very enemy himself, that these are within me, and that I myself am the enemy who must be loved? What then?" Yesterday, I am going to assume there's some unfinished business about this, and would like to suggest that I begin with giving you just a couple other pieces to the puzzle, and then I'd like to just have a conversation and probe and push me a little bit on what you've heard. Again, picking up on Edna's comments. Specifically, when I first met her a few days ago, I went up to her and said that I had used her quote from one of her books, From This Good Earth, probably several dozen times, and I've done it in respect to dream work that I've done, Edna. And the quote, I think you said either your own grandmother or somebody had mentioned this. It's a little truism, altruism. It goes like this: religion can't be taught, it can only be caught. You see, take a look at the diagram here. This is teaching up here. Right here, through the ego. You instruct. But the real action comes down here. And that's finally why religious experience is a gift. You can't... All you can do is provide the container. Then you gotta wait till the fire catches. It's like falling in love. Have any of you tried to match make for folks? I mean, once in a while that works, right? Once in a while, but most of the time, boom. I mean, it looks like a perfect match, doesn't it? But it doesn't work. It's because the word love has to do with the unconscious. Look at the words we use. Falling in love. Falling in love. And you feel love from down here, not from up here. From down here. There's several other words that we use in our language that describe what I would call the relationship of the ego to the self. One is a nervous breakdown. Nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm. What exactly is a nervous breakdown? Okay. I have heard physicians say sure. There is no such thing.
Sure. A nervous breakdown. Look at the ego. Does anybody want to comment on what they would perceive, using this schematic, this map, what a nervous breakdown would be?
The ego falls down.
The ego cracks. It cracks. Too much pressure. We call that illness. It hasn't always been called illness. It used to be called a religious experience. That's what it used to be called. Now, there are different levels of nervous breakdowns and different, you know, degrees of that. All of us in this room have had a nervous breakdown. Every time you lose control. Every time you lose control. And I kick my dog and when I'm upset and I'm losing it. I'm losing balance. And then the unconscious comes through and I'm frustrated, I'll hit something. Those are mini nervous breakdowns that we have. There's a wonderful story from the monastic tradition about this that would frustrate mental health professionals. Many of them. It's a story that comes from Nikos Kazantzakis from the Isle of Crete, and he talks about a man who went to the monastery at Athos, an ancient legend, to meet God, and he went into a cave. And he was there for 10 days and he came out and he said, God, I'm ready. God said, no, you're not, go back. So he went back for another 10 days and this time he was very hungry, very thirsty, and he could hardly stand and he walked and he said, I'm ready, God. God said, you're not. So he went back and this time he crawled out after about 20 days and he said, God, I'm ready. God said, you're not. And the monk said, I'll break. And God said, then break. Do you understand that? Some of you do, some of you don't. How many of you have a relative or have yourself ever been in AA groups or Al-Anon groups? Okay. Aldous Huxley, who's one of the intellectuals of the 20th century, says that the greatest historical movement in the 20th century, the greatest spiritual movement in the 20th century is Alcoholics Anonymous. And history will judge this movement to be one of the most profound things spiritually to happen in the modern centuries around the world. Basically began in New York City in the basement of an Episcopal church. Interesting. Basement. 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 A lot of dreams that you have are about caverns, underneath the ground, tunnels, basements. AA began in the basement of Episcopal Church, Sam Shoemaker and Bill Wilson. The first step of AA, the first step to recovery, the first step to recovery is what? I am not in control of my life. I am addicted to alcohol. It's an acknowledgement that the ego is not in control. And if you think you can convince somebody, if you think that recognition comes from the outside and not from the inside, think about the people that you have tried to, quote, help. You cannot do it. It's got to come from the inside. The defenses are so sophisticated. I once talked to a recovering alcoholic, a good friend of mine, who said, John, on a one-to-one, an alcoholic beats anybody because the disease is so strong. And what you're really talking to when you talk to an alcoholic is you're talking to a disease. And so what happens is you have to be able to discern that, and the best time, and that's why, of course, that wonderful spiritual insight of people who are affiliated with the recovery movement is to let go and to let God. And let go means quit trying to control the person. You can't do it. You can't really control. All you finally have is what God has given yourself to take care of yourself. And to be as honest as you can about the pain and the consequences of that person's behavior. You love the person, but you be real straight about the behavior, the consequences of the behavior. Nervous breakdown. You see, in the religious community, that's why this strange phenomenon happens where an alcoholic will say, and I've been at meetings where somebody will say to me, and the group to say, I thank God I'm an alcoholic. That's what they say. Now they've lost two marriages, they've lost several jobs, and they're in a group and they say, thank God I'm an alcoholic. What's going on there? What's happening?
We're supposed to thank God for everything, no matter.
Okay.
It's the only way they would have come close to God.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. They have discovered a new part of themselves through the addiction, through the pain here. And they have claimed their own brokenness and seen that as a path of their particular spiritual journey that they have walked. It's an integration of their illness. It's an integration of their pain. Okay? So this is what I would call the ego-self axis. And Edna, when she says religion can only be... who did you quote that from?
I didn't say that.
You quoted
it's
it.
It's the plagiarism.
It's a plagiarism.
Yeah.
Okay. Religion can't be taught. It can only be caught. That's all I remember.
Don't use my name in association.
All right.
Make me more guilty.
I will. Okay. I will not. All right. All right, all right. I'll back up. Joseph Campbell. You know Joseph Campbell? Anybody see the series? Okay, he has a wonderful little piece in him when he says, if you follow your bliss, if you follow your bliss, not this, but this, the bliss means your joy. My wife is an artist. The summer we came back after Holden Village, we were on the way back to Chicago, ripped up her teaching certificate, threw it in a McDonald hamburger's waste paper basket. I said, what are you doing? And she said, I want to be an artist. That's who I am. I want to draw. Well, it was pretty rough. But now she is... I consider her a very accomplished illustrator. She's done about 27 children's books, and it's taken a long time, but she followed her bliss. What Campbell says is if you follow the nudgings of the inner self, there will be things that will come to meet you. The universe, the cosmos, comes to meet you. And people appear. You don't seek them out. They come to you. That's what Joseph Campbell says. In terms of working with, you see, young adults, like in my profession with the church and my ministry, it's very difficult because young adults are trying to sort this out here. They are usually working under heavy scripts or kind of shoulds from their parents and from the society. I had this, if you go into the Village Center, you'll see the theme for the weekends called Discipleship. Frogs, Princesses, and Other Kingdom Tales. I'm using fairy tales to help young people, teenagers, understand the different ways God speaks to us and the different roads we're asked to follow as persons in our life. And among the different roads, one is what we call, I've used the illustration of the what I call the lover. The other one is the warrior, and the third is what I would call the poet, or the writer, or the artist, musician. And, you know, leaders in the church, most of them are lovers. So they think everybody else should be lovers too. Go out and help people. See? If you're a good musician, the best way you can glorify God is to sit down and compose the best doggone song you've ever composed. Or if you're a poet or a writer, the best thing you can do is to sit down and write the best piece that you can write. And God's plan, or I would say what Jung would call the destiny of the psyche for us, each of us, it's different. We each have some kind of part of some pattern, and to discover that in life, and oftentimes we discover it in retrospect. Oh, that's why I'm here. That's why I've come, not what I thought I was here for. That's this recognition of this deeper inner self. But the tension between the ego and the self, this is the important creative problem that I want to encourage you to really carry. Paul Tournier, again, the Swiss physician, has a wonderful story of how complex. I mean, you think this is complex, just listen to this one. He has a wonderful book called The Weak and the Strong. And he says, spiritually, you see, good health has nothing to do with spiritual health. You need to know that, number one. That's the biggest piece of baloney being sold in this society. And all the psychological studies, every one of them that I did in graduate school, in a secular graduate school, University of Wisconsin, showed that emotional health has nothing to do with physical appearance. You can have the most beautiful young person, and they can be an absolute mess inside. And if you, at the university like I work at, and see all the eating disorders among the young women who could be models in national magazines, and inside they are dying, virtually dying, committing suicide. You see that incredible contrast. Tournier, The Weak and the Strong. Carry this one with you when you leave Alden Village. He says that if the ego is real strong and tight and rigid and doesn't listen, you can be pretty healthy. In fact, you can be too mean to be sick. Have you heard that one? Too ornery to be sick. My father-in-law is like that. My father-in-law has 7 kids. He's an emotional tyrant. He destroyed several of the children. I mean, emotionally, they will live wounded all their lives. Bankrupt his business, a crippled man in many respects, healthy, just tough, eats anything, lived to be 100. So Tournier goes on to say, when those people begin to get spiritually well, guess what happens to them physically?
It's consider it.
They start to get sick. And the sickness is a sign of a spiritual illness. That's turning eight. On the opposite end, those of people who are chronically ill a lot, as they begin to integrate, they begin to get physically well. So you see, illness is not always the bad guy from a spiritual point of view here. And this is one of the mysteries of the world of the unconscious. And to wish for long life rather than a quality of life needs to be, is an issue that, you know, the society needs to probably look at more closely than it has. Yeah, go.
Just briefly, could you say where transactional analysis, I'm okay, you're okay, fits with that,
sure.
Parent, child, and adult?
You bet. Transactional analysis is a school of thought that essentially says, built on this, basically triggering off of this understanding, it comes out of psychoanalytical theory, which is Freudian theory, basically says, there is a child lives down here, but it's very good. It says there is a natural child and there is a distorted child. So in other words, this isn't all pretty down here. Do you remember? This is, you know, but anyway, there's a child and there's an adult, which is the ego, and there is the parent, which is the superego. And the ego's task in life is to balance the two. A lot of people are driven by shoulds, by oughts, and other people are driven by their impulses. And somewhere, God has created us to, we're part animals, you know? And we're also part angels. We're spiritual creatures, but we're also animals. And one of the things that I run across with young people, especially in the church, is they forget their animal side. So I have to teach them about their animal side. So that's one of the tensions. The ego self axis and the tension between the two. Falling in love, nervous breakdown. I don't wish a nervous breakdown on anyone, let me assure you. But when it happens, there is a spiritual dimension to that experience. And there is a chance for a new self to emerge. Maybe the last piece I'll share about this tension has to do with infant baptism. Do you understand, those of you who are Lutherans, why some Christians baptize children and others don't? Somebody try that and see if we can have a little brief discussion about that.
What creates a tension on the child?
Okay, say more about that, please, Harriet. Like, how do you mean a tension, or what would you...
Well, it makes the child have to reach a height that maybe it's not ready for.
Okay.
We feel that a child, in my church, that a child is without sin, and that they should not commit themselves or become a member of the church until they are of an age where they can decide.
Right. What tradition are you from?
A Christian church.
Great. It's what we call believer's baptism, is what that tradition is called within the church history. Now, you all know that there are two different traditions that are in the church. One is, your first name is?
Vivian.
Yes, Vivian, yes. Vivian's tradition says that it's appropriate that a person make a decision about whether or not to take this sign on. But there are others of us in the Lutheran, Catholic, Episcopal communities who do baptize infants. Now look at this diagram and tell me why we baptize infants. Yeah, well, that's a distortion in the church's teaching. And I would say that believer's baptism comes through the ego. See, we wait for the child to make a decision, so the baptism comes, and Lutherans also practice that. I've had many adult baptisms, and there have been many adult baptisms here at Holden Village. But for those of us who do baptize children, we baptize this. Before the ego, even before the child even knows its names, we make a promise as a community to the child, and we say, we believe you are loved before you even know you're loved. We believe and we make a promise that we will try to help you understand that inside of you there is a child of God that has a place in the universe. And then at confirmation time, the child ritualistically, like the bar mitzvah, claims the baptism that was given to them as a child. That's how it's supposed to work. But of course, that's not the way it works, is it? Do you think a child claims the baptism during confirmation? Usually their ego's not strong enough to resist pressure from parents and pastor. And so there's a violation of the soul that occurs, as far as I'm concerned. The child claims the baptism and stands up and said, I believe, and no one's really given them an option to say, I don't believe. And that's one of the problems. That you can't say yes until you can say no. And that's one of the problems we have in the confirmation program in many of our Lutheran churches. Real difficult.
We do dedicate the parents to raise that
child. Right. So there is a ritual that
there
you have.
Is. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay, I'm just moving real quick here because I want to move into a couple of different dynamics, and then we're going to split up. One is what I call the magnus opus. That's Latin. Anybody?
The great.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that comes from Jung. And he said, one of the work of dreams and one of the work that we have in our life, the soul work that we have in life, this is what we call soul work, has to do with the great work, which means all the work of salvation inside of us. In other words, the world coming together, inside and outside. It's a spiritual reality, it's also a political reality. But there's a movement that Jung called toward wholeness that is carried by the self. We had a great talk after the session last night, Owen and I, and he was saying as a probation officer that he, one of his first priorities was to try to touch this in one of his delinquent kids. And it was hard to do, but if he could touch it, there was all kinds of tremendous energy. And oh, because you see, underneath, no matter what the behavior is, and I think this is supported by Jung's point of view, unlike Freud, who was very pessimistic about human nature, Jung believed there is a hunger for wholeness, a pull toward salvation, a pull toward harmony. And as we get older, it even becomes more important that we integrate. Once I talked to a group of young people, and they said, why do all these old people go to church? Why is there only old people going to church? And I said, well, that's a good question. I said, have you ever thought they might just be a little smarter than the rest of you? See? You know, they've lived, they've seen loved ones die, they've seen presidents come and go. All the things that you think are important, they've seen pass through. So they're looking for a deeper reality, a transcendent reality. The great work, the opus, or the magnus opus, Jung called it. And that's going on inside of us, he believed, as well as outside of us. Which leads us to the last concept I want to leave with you before we break. And now this is going to be a little touchy and difficult. So I'm not going to apologize for that. I think I'll just say that's the way you're made. I mean, as far as I'm concerned. And so, you know, we'll just see where it'll take us. One of the ways that the ego deals with the world, if it can't listen, if it can't integrate, and there's always a tension now. Nobody has that access worked out. Remember St. Paul? That which I do, I can't. And that which I don't want to do, I do. Do you remember that?
Amen.
See, that's the war. That's the war that goes inside of you. Those of you with eating disorders, addictions, you know what I'm talking about. Those can't be solved by the ego. And when somebody says, why don't these people pick themselves up, you know, and take care of themselves? Why don't they just stand up like I did? Oh, where are you talking from, folks? Come on. You're talking from the ego. Now, that's okay in the sense, and that's where I would part from Carol, maybe, although she didn't really reflect her own personal position. I wish, if I would have went down here, I might have pushed her harder and see where she would have come out.
That's right.
But she was a good pastor there. She allowed a lot of stuff to happen. I would have gotten a fight sooner, I think.
She didn't have time.
No, she was good. If the ego can't integrate, can't hear, which none of us can fully do, it projects. So the self, come like this, this unconscious comes out here, and the ego sees it, and we call it a projection. Tom yesterday talked for an hour about projection. And what did he say it was? It was the enemy. It can also be the hero. These are projections. And all of us carry them. And they're parts of ourselves. They're parts of ourselves. But we can't deal with it, so we deal with it out there. Example. Little child who doesn't integrate much. A little child can't integrate. Remember, the ego is not developed. What does a little child do if they're upset, if mom and dad got in a fight, and they go to school? What do?
They get in a fight.
They get in a fight or they cause behavior problems. They don't go to the teacher and talk about mom and dad's fight. They act it out. And that's what we as a society end up doing politically. And that's what's so absolutely dangerous, that we will act out and destroy, essentially, each other unless we can somehow arrive at some kind of spiritual maturity. And I told Tom this morning, I think also the 20th century will be judged in a very positive way for these groups of people going overseas and breaking down the projections. You know, and meeting Russians and traveling and going down to Nicaragua. I mean, all these myths and things are breaking down, and we're able to see the common ground that we have as people. Let me go back to Carol real quick. Carol was in a dialogue with a couple of you about the poor, God being on the side of the poor. And hey, I've been in this one 100 times. And there's a lot of pastors who don't like where I come out on this. So let me say something about that. I believe that there is a wonderful fairy tale that best describes the problem. It's called Pinocchio. I took my 6-year-old son there several years ago in Milwaukee to see this in a play. And I was quite bored. It was a first grade party, and I was up in the balcony. I thought, oh hum, you know. And as this Pinocchio drama took place, I was in training in the psychiatric hospital, and I thought, my, this is marvelous. For a couple of reasons. If you remember the story, Pinocchio is this wooden puppet, right, with his father Geppetto. Well, Pinocchio keeps getting in trouble for the first part of the play. And who rescues him? Do you recall that at all? Yeah, that's the Walt Disney version, Jiminy Cricket. The Blue Fairy comes. The Blue Fairy comes and rescues him all the time. Well, then finally he really blows it, and Geppetto goes looking for him. He comes back and he said, oh, no, I've really done it. So he's repentful. And then the Blue Fairy arrives and says, wonderful. Let's go. And she says, I love you, Pinocchio, but not this time. This time, you have to go alone. So he goes alone. He goes alone. He gets swallowed in the belly of the whale. Belly of the whale, unconscious, down deep, underneath the sea. Figures out a way to get out, and whatever comes out, and they're reunited, of course, the father and the son. And at the end, the blue fairy appears, and what does she do to Pinocchio, the wooden boy?
Becomes a real boy.
What does it mean to become a real boy? The problem of the ego and the unconscious. That's the fairy tale very graphically describes the tension. The tension between being hugged and needing to be hugged, needing to be saved by a blue fairy, which all of us need. And those of you, and me also, as we reach the end of our life, I hope there's a lot of blue fairies around to care for me. You know, my kids and a good community and a pastor who will bring me communion. And but there are some things in life that the blue fairy's not going to be there for. And God made me that way too. And I'm just going to have to do it. That's the tension. When you get the hug, or when you give the hug, and when you get the boot in the butt. And you can't predict that for anybody, because oftentimes the very time when the child or the person in your parish need, they please hug me, please hug me. You know what they need? They need a kick in the ass, absolutely. And the people who say, don't touch me, I don't need a hug, I'm fine, I'm doing great, Pastor, I'm doing just great. Those are the people that need the hug.
Amen.
See? And it's tough. It's tough, folks. All of us as parents have made a lot of mistakes about that. We've hugged them when we should have, and when we needed a hug. And adolescents, delinquent adolescents, need... I mean, you're a wizard, because that's a tough one to call, isn't it? And these little tough guys with their chips on their shoulders, they need to be hugged. They need to be hugged, a lot of them. So, and they also need tough rules. So, you know, that's what's exciting, working with criminals or delinquents, that you really have to use your spiritual discernment with these people. Okay, projection. It's getting kind of late here. I think, is the tape off on this? There are different kinds of dreams. And you know this. We haven't talked about what I call the big dream yet. We're going to talk about that tomorrow when we talk about Scripture. But most of the dream work has to do with how God is fashioning you and working within you. And so these dynamics of what's going on inside you and the people you love is the work of God. And it's probably 80% of the dreams that you have to do with who you are and what's happening with you. So that's why we're talking about this. At this point, we'll get into big dreams tomorrow. Telepathic dreams, dreams of predictive dreams, numinous dreams. We'll get into that. But this is the kind of a workshop of the soul that I'd like to honor today in terms of the dream world. So let's hear some stories about connections you've made in your own life with these dynamics. Louise, tell your story, and I think it's real fascinating.
I'm taking German at a university, which is 5 minutes away from me. I'm taking German at a university every day because I'm going to visit my son, who is in Germany. And the first couple days of being in the German class, where we spoke nothing but German, blew my mind. I had forgotten that I only spoke German until I was 5 years old. It felt like coming home.
See the word she used? Uh-huh. Coming home.
And it was deep. It was deep inside. Something deep inside. Yeah. He spoke to that I was learning and said, this is me. that the structure was, right. Oh yeah, half of my poetry is written backwards like the German language.
See?
And as I just told John, as if that wasn't enough, about the end of the first quarter, there was a section in the German text about divorce and the rising divorce rate and what is the cause of divorce and so forth. It hurt me to read it. I've been divorced twice. I can read all about the divorce rate in English, and it's simply facts. It hurt me to read that. It hurt me to write a paper about divorce in German that we were asked to do.
You see what she's experiencing with the language as a child. She has been able to, through the language, boy, this is making me think, make all kinds of connections. Through the language of the child, she is then reclaiming the wound that is inside of her, that has been lying dormant, yeah, even in her adult life. That's very, very interesting. Others of you, about, let's hear some chopping wood, ironing shirts stories. This is a great one.
Well, yeah. When I'm upset, I just get the ironing board out and I iron. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's the new kind of material that doesn't need ironing or not.
Say something about how that relates to the diagram, Harriet. Can you put that together?
It soothes myself.
Remember ritual? Remember ritual? You all think it means going to church. No. After last night's session, I was a little anxious, you know. And you notice what I did after supper? Anybody notice?
Clean up the kitchen.
Yeah. I went to do dishes. Because it was something I could do. It was a ritual I could do. I wouldn't have to think about it, and I knew it would help my soul, and it did.
Do you know why you were upset?
Oh, yeah, I was scared and wondering if I was communicating and, you know, wondering if I was meeting expectations and my ego. I was worried about things, thinking about my family and whatever.
Mm-hmm. This may be a little bit backtracking,
yeah,
but you mentioned about a father-in-law who destroyed literally.
Yes.
Well, I have an ex-husband like that. He's a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality.
Uh-huh.
What on earth? I've tried to try. I've gone to Al-Anon because I realized later that he was an alcoholic and also the pills he was a physician. Now, where does this kind of a thing start? Does it start in a bad childhood, or can that be traced back, or what? I've tried to figure out what caused it.
Yeah.
I tried to convince him of things, but it never worked. He was always right. Everybody else was wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, psychopathology is a whole field, and the danger of any kind of theoretical reflection, what I would call the danger of reductionism. In other words, that you can find a reason for everything in this diagram. And I want to say that that's not appropriate. There is what we call a physiogenetic origin of some psychiatric illnesses. On the other hand, there's also they can be psychologically, the origin can be psychological as well. And he was in a profession which is very dangerous psychologically. He was a physician who has absolute control. I mean, have you ever watched physicians on wards? Are you nurses? I mean, that's changing a little bit, but it's dangerous. Just like the legal profession, sometimes academic professions can be that way. Where you have these 60 little young people, you know, in front of you every day, going yes, 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 you know, it's dangerous. So I can't really speak to your specific situation, except when this is too rigid, and the reason it gets rigid is because it gets scared, and usually that comes out of childhood, where you get either traumatized, so you have to defend yourself, you have to defend, and you build up defense mechanisms. And this becomes very rigid, and then under pressure it splits. And then you have what we call a schizophrenic or split personality. You have different personalities that operate. And, you know, those are all dynamics that operate. Edna, you had something.
Well, I was just going to say that when I'm upset, I make bread.
Yeah.
It's the kneading.
The kneading, yes.
That,
another
so
ritual.
Sometimes we have lots of homemade bread.
That's very good. And chopping wood, Paul Bow, I think, chops wood. You see, that's a spiritual discipline. And when you take away those things from people, I remember once going home and saying, I was feeling pretty good, I had a good day, and I walked in and said, I'm going to make supper tonight. And Diana turned around and she says, you're not going to make supper tonight. And I said, well, I want to give you a break. Come on, get out of here. You know. She said, don't you touch me. She says, I want to make supper. I need to make supper. I went, okay. And I realized she needed for her cooking was that at that time in her life and still is. I mean, that's, she's in the kitchen alone. She doesn't like anybody else in there. And
I can go with that. Yeah, I can understand that. I'm never as happy as when I'm cooking a meal for somebody else.
Yes. These are rituals. These are... These are spiritual disciplines, these rituals, and they're important. And one of the great things you can teach kids, your grandkids, and encourage your own kids, although many of them I know are gone but long by now, but is to teach them rituals.
They're not long gone yet.
Teach them about rituals, putting away dishes. You know, my dad used to oil his gun, you know, up in Minnesota, and take care of his fishing rod. And my generation, we know nothing about maintenance. We use things and throw it away. We don't know how to maintain. We don't know how to do ritual. We don't know how to care for things. And that's essentially a spiritual thing. And we're, our generation, my generation, is all the poorer for it.
Why is that? Why did we let you be that way?
Well, I think I'm biased. I think we got trapped by the ego. We forgot there was a spiritual world. We forgot that being more efficient isn't always the best way to go for the soul. We forgot that being well isn't always best for the soul. Being healthy isn't always best for the soul. We forgot all, those are all secrets of the spiritual world that we have forgotten. Think of Martin Luther. Now, I'm biased, he's the originator of our tradition. He would have been diagnosed without any doubt as a manic depressive in our society. I mean, there's enough evidence in his writings. And his he would have been medicated with lithium, and we probably wouldn't have had the Reformation, you know. Oh, and Kierkegaard, oh my goodness. See? And I'm not knocking lithium, and I'm not knocking the terrors of those kinds of psychiatric disorders or you know, situations of the psyche or soul, but God's so much bigger than the ego thinks. God works so much more mysterious than what we think. And that's why I like this little dialogue with Carol here this morning when we were talking about God being on the side of the poor and, you know, and wondering what all that means. Well, okay, who's the poor? See? Who's the poor? Well, it's the physically poor. It's the economically. Well, okay. You know, I mean, you can probe that. You can move into that and look at that in a lot of different ways. And listen to some of the things Mother Teresa says about our culture. Yeah.
I was just wondering, your definition of wholeness then has nothing to do with the physical at all?
Say it again now.
Just the integration of the self with the soul?
No, I said that with people who are chronically ill, for instance, the ill, then when the integration comes, there's a physical wellness that comes.
I heard you say
that. Yeah, that's so it works versus.
Would you disagree with the idea that wholeness is a perfect integration, perhaps, of the physical, the emotional, the spiritual?
Oh, sure, but I would say that's the kingdom of God, and that's not going
to
be, that's not,
Jesus
right, but I
believe,
yeah, and I think that the road to that is a road like Alice in Wonderland, or a road like the Wizard of Oz, and it's full of detours.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but along the way, there are different tasks, and that's what's so dangerous when you try to give advice to somebody, another young person, for instance.
Well, I'm talking about your inner journey with you.
Okay, well, for instance, okay, let me give you an example. As a campus pastor in Oregon, I used to have, where is Ann here? Okay, Oregon. I had once a young man come to me and want to talk about dreams. And he was from a wealthy family, and, you know, he was very sharp and reflective. I talked to him 10 minutes and said, it's over. We don't need to talk anymore. He said, why? I said, well, you need to go look for a job. Well, he got real angry with me. And I said, you've been hiding in your dreams. You've been hiding in your unconscious. You've been really getting off on this. And you're 21 years old, you never held a job. You need to get out there and wash dishes for 6 months. See? So the task that we have, it's not always appropriate to listen to dreams. Sometimes people need to listen to their dreams less. You see how complicated, that's what I'm trying to say, it gets complicated. What the task is in our spiritual journey, what it is that we're asked to do, depends on the place in our life. And what has come before us and what comes ahead of us.
The discernment is very important.
Discernment, wonder, a great word. First time it's been used since these sessions that I have been leading have been used. That probably is a beautiful word. I love the word, and it's very important. And anybody in the medical world will tell you diagnosis comes before, you know, any kind of treatment strategy. Edna?
Isn't there a danger that ritualism can become obsession?
No.
Because sometimes I find that happening to me. I see a gun wrapper maybe on the path, and I go in the house, and I'm going to do something else, and I think that gun wrapper, I have to pick it up.
Let me scare you here. Are you ready? You're tough, so I'm going to scare you. Usually obsessional disorders or obsessional compulsive disorders, and not, I'm using a clinical word, but those behaviors are simply exaggerations of behaviors that all of us have. Okay?
Yeah.
That usually has its psychological origins in the need for control. And when I work with an obsessional person who needs to wash their hands all the time or needs to do things in order all the time, my advice to them is to try to tap into what I call the child. They need to learn to play. They need to learn to trust and to let go. The obsessional ritualization is a need to control. My son, when he went into junior high, got a phobia in an inner city school in Seattle. He had to wash his hands 6 times a day. And it was the way that he tried to cope with what he was feeling, was a loss of control. Now, it wasn't that acute in any way in your sense, but it could be that part in you that's coming up saying, let go, lady. You know, whether it be your granddaughter or your husband or whoever, or your health, I don't know what it might have been.
It was just a gum wrapper.
Okay. thank you.
That's a great way.
Yeah, that's right. More stories here, more connections. Yeah, let's go.
This gentleman yesterday asked about working with juveniles, delinquents, art and so on. In Seattle, there's a theater group that uses street kids, and they get a sense of accomplishment.
Right. They're able to go down. The one wonderful thing about drama is it gives permission for people. I've done 2 plays in my life. In one sense, but I guess as a pastor, I'm kind of on stage and dramatizing or acting in one sense all the time. But I've been in 2 dramas, one in college, my senior year, and one at Holden Village here. And I still remember it, 1971, how healing it was for me. I was able to get out of my ego and become somebody else and let this crazy, I was a funny plumber. And I had to go down here and find my funny plumber inside. And I didn't think I had one. I remember being real anxious. How can I do this? I can't do this. I'm not funny or anything. So I had to go down and find it, and it was wonderfully healing. And so drama and role-playing is a part of a lot of forms of therapy. Some of you know that. Where people act out and are able to try to externalize what they feel. Exactly. Real, real important. Another thing cut in our schools, isn't it? Drama.
One thing I think is lost somewhat these days, when I was a child growing up, grade school, high school in a small country town in South Dakota, every year they had an operetta or a play, and yep. I used all the kids from first grade on up yep. to senior high school. And I happened to be a snowflake in one of them. Gives you a chance to give vent to your pent-up emotions.
You bet. And the pent-up emotions are living down here where your dreams live. Yes?
Well, at what age do individuals become afflicted? I had a 2-year-old granddaughter who washed her hands until they bleed.
You bet.
She was mm-hmm. only 2.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. You know, I can't... Again, unless I would know more about the situation, and it would probably take a number of sessions and things to look at that. There, it's real funny when it comes to psychiatric disorders, because there's always chemical things going on too. There's physiological things going on, and the question is, which comes first, the chicken or the egg, on these things? And it's a complicated discussion in the medical community about this. And right now, the preferred treatment for psychiatric illnesses is medication. Although the shift of balance is coming. And now even the most conservative of physicians would say, in terms of their attitude or skepticism toward the inner world, is that medication must be combined with therapy, must be combined with talking, so that this, once you stabilize the ego, that there, this is going to be integrated. Okay?
You ask us to relate our dreams, and I have yes. been having dreams of extreme frustration, and I had one this morning that probably exploded through my mind when the alarm clock went off, and I think it probably leads back to the fact that I'm so frustrated in my walking right now. So it's coming out in dreams of frustration.
Let me ask you this. I looked at the schedule, and I'm going to supper announced tonight. Those people who just want to deal and talk a bit about dreams they're having, or dreams that they've had that have been powerful. Let's have a little 45-minute session here tonight. We have a free evening tonight, and those of you who wish to, it'll be kind of apart from our other sessions, but. Because I think that would be interesting for the people who, other people would be interested. I don't want to tap into that right now. Because once I do, I want to honor you, you know? I want to honor you, and I'm limited with ego constrictions with time. So, that's one of the things I fight with when I do these workshops. I was telling Andra, the ego watches time, okay, and also participation and other considerations, and yet I'm dealing with this world. And I made plenty of mistakes by saying, gee, tell me about your dreams. Why don't you tell them? And all of a sudden, 45 minutes later, you know, back, we haven't even got through the alphabet yet, but we've had some, so it's a difficult problem for me, and I guess with your group, we're going to do some live dream work here. We might use your dream tomorrow. as we do that, if you're open to it. But tonight will be a chance for you to share some.
Can the rest of us
That's open to anybody.
Oh.
Anybody. And
I would like to ask a question, sure. Not about what you're talking
you
about
bet.
Exactly,
no,
except
ahead.
I don't want to leave the critical part of it because
yes.
I have this on my mind.
You bet.
You keep speaking of nervous breakdown, and she questioned it.
Yes.
In the medical community, we don't hear that so much anymore.
Okay.
Is that depression? And,
well,
and is
yeah.
depression being treated otherwise than with drugs, is what I'm asking.
There are... This is how complex this gets. There are different kinds of depressions. There's a reactive depression, which usually is a very human thing and comes in reaction to a situation, like the loss of a loved one, okay, or the loss of health. This is natural. If you don't get depressed, then you're not grieving. There's something wrong with you. If you don't cry for someone you love, I mean, that's, or your kids leaving home, that's a normal thing. That's, half the Psalms are depressing. Half the Psalms have been written in depression. 50% of the Psalms of the Bible are sad, saying, God, why did you do this to me? And that's a way to express that season of our soul. Somebody who's never depressed, I get worried about. Like the Sunshine Christians, you know? Praise God all the time. The Indians have taught me that. They say, hey, white people always want to live in summer all the time. Look at nature. Sometimes it's winter. But people who are depressed all the time, they're not whole either. They're not whole either, see. So back to depression. There's a reactive depression. That's normal. And I've seen a lot of physicians treat that with medication, and I oppose that. I think the soul needs to cry, needs to weep, and many cultures are much better at that than ours. I don't know, Edna, where you did your research for the Sacred Tree book, but if you've ever been to a funeral on an Indian reservation, I've told my wife, I want to be, ask the Indians to come to bury me. They know how. Wonderful. Crying, hugging, just, it was beautiful. Love pouring out.
They also lacerated themselves.
Yeah,
and
some of that.
Hair
yeah, some of that, yes, to show the grief. Now, going back, there's another kind of depression called involutional depression. This is tricky. This comes from inside here, and it's not externally related. It comes at any time, it can come different times of your life, but it'll come up from the inside. And this is real tough stuff. Oftentimes it has to do with stuff, wounds down here that have been buried for years, and all of a sudden come up. And you don't know why you're getting depressed. And suddenly you're sinking. There's also depression that's related to chemical, hormonal shifts in the body. That, you know, has to be tested with blood tests and isolated. So there's a number of different forms of depression. Some very natural and normal. Others are dangerous. I should say something about suicide, shouldn't I? Before we close here. Because that's a tricky one that is important to acknowledge, I think. And I probably have time for that. To close here. Suicide. Most of your first aid stuff about suicide says what? Get next to the person, right? Talk them through, right? Tell them they're okay. In other words, reinforce the ego. But from a spiritual point of view, that's not enough. Why? You're not getting down deep enough. In other words, they're going to try it again. And those of you who have worked with suicidal people know that they do try again. That somehow, after their ego is stabilized, they need to sit down with somebody, and you need to ask them, and they need to ask themselves, what in me needs to die? Something in me needs to die. What is it? My attitude? My expectations? My relationship with somebody I love? Until that is ever dealt with, the suicide will come back in not maybe overt terms like cutting your wrists, but through chronic, slow suicide like drinking or overeating, very subtle ways where you're slowly killing yourself. Mm-hmm. So suicide basically has two approaches when you deal with it. The ego side, which is important, and then the inner work. Dreams, and we'll close with this, has to do, 80% of our dreams have to do with the dynamics here of how these relate to one another. And how the self, oftentimes, one of the symbols of the self, oftentimes, is a child in a dream. And in a dream, oftentimes, people who chase you or try to break into your house are projections that are trying to come back in. I had one last night, surprised me, because usually I don't listen to my dreams unless I'm in the midst of a decision or trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do. You know, I don't listen every night or anything, it's too much work. But last night, boom! Somebody trying to break into my house. And I wrote down all about him because I didn't know he was there. Last night, a part of myself tried to come back to me. And I don't know him. And I'll be spending the next couple of days trying to figure out who he is. All right. Those of you who aren't in touch with your dreams, I said I'd give you a practical hint. Here it is. If the ego looks... Well, first of all, the reason you don't remember. Four reasons. Number one, nobody told you it was important. That's number one. Nobody trained you. If you grew up in an Indian community in the Northwest, dreams, you would know your dreams. You would have listened. And you would have been taught how to listen. One of the ways that Indian people use is sleep deprivation. If you stay up, do you remember REM sleep? You get more REM sleep, right? So if you stay up a long time, you're going to dream. There are some foods you can eat that can trigger a dream. Brewer's yeast will trigger a dream. Have you ever heard of a dream pillow? Dream pillows are made of herbs. This a German woman told me this. Her grandmother had brought one from Germany. Certain herbs, I don't know what the herbs are, but if you sleep on them, they can also trigger the unconscious. But the most important thing here is that the ego turn inward and want to listen. You make a conscious decision with your ego and say, I want to know you. I haven't met you. I want to get to know you. And the way you do that is in the form, I use a prayer, but for those of you who are uncomfortable with that, you can use another method, which is simply to say, tonight, I want to remember my dreams. Or, Lord, tonight, help me. Speak to me in my dreams. You say that 12 times. 12 times softly to yourself. By your bed, you have a pen and a pencil. And within, and I've worked with several hundred people now, and it hasn't failed. It took one person 7 days. He was a salesman. And he promised me he never dreamed in his life. It took him 7 days. It took me 3 days. I was a person. Who is a person who said they don't dream here? Yes. I believed I never dreamed until 1980, where I slept, when I slept on this porch with a copy of John Sanford's Invisible Partners, and I decided I would try. And I had my first recorded dream. I mean, I had a couple of nightmares when I was young, but that was about it. And that's where my dream world started, right here. So you say to yourself, I want to remember. And it might take you 2 or 3 nights. But I'm hoping by Friday, you've got 2 more nights now, that you'll catch an image. Now, you'll just catch an image. You'll be that quick. And you'll have to catch it. Why do the images fleet so fast?
Projection.
The ego. The ego slams down.
Oh.
You see, your conscience slams down right away on you. until you learn. And it's like a garden. You water the garden. What happens when you water the garden? Give it a little light.
Weeds come up.
Exactly. In other words, the ego realizes that this isn't going to hurt you. And you get more and more access. And you can more readily access your dreams. That's one of the reasons we don't remember. The second one, you haven't been told that they're important. Second reason is that you've got a strong ego. I got a strong ego. And, you know, I'm tough. And I just slam it down. I mean, I don't think I need that world. I didn't think I needed that world. I was getting along okay. My wife could have that world, but I didn't need it. So that's another reason. You have a strong ego. So you might really start dreaming when you really start to suffer and the ego starts to break. That's when the dreams may really come, but if you don't choose to go down. The third reason is you may be on sedatives or alcohol. And lastly, there are some people in the room, just like some people are better, have different gifts physically, some people have different gifts spiritually, psychologically, some people have more ready access. But in my experience, because I'm a living witness here, you can access that world because everybody has it. That's scientifically proven.